You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Tropical hot dog night!
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Dave's Gone By, 90 minutes of talk radio, comedy, music, and whatnot, coming to live from the internal organs of Merrick, Long Island. If you've just been listening to Teen America, where they branded me an intellectual, thank you guys, don't flip the dial so quick, you might just like what we do here, plus both the Jets and the Giants are out of the playoffs, so what the heck else are you going to listen to, Andy Rooney? I don't like digital radio dials, all those numbers and buttons you have to push. I'm an old man, and I have stubby thumbs. I try to push 1240, and I get 1480. Instead of my favorite teen program, I get a Spanish fellow speaking in tongues. I'm sure he's a nice enough preacher, but one tongue is enough. And speaking of tongues, did you ever get a piece of food stuck in your teeth, and then you dig for it with your tongue, and you realize it won't come out that way? You have to use your fingernail, or a toothpick. But every time you get another piece of food stuck in your teeth, you still reach around and try to get it with your tongue. People are creatures of habit, dumb habits. And speaking of habits, I miss nuns who dress like nuns. You see a nun on the street today, she might look like any other woman on the block. Is she a nun? What about her? That one's definitely not a nun, but maybe she's on her way to Mass. I have nothing against the church trying to stay current with the times, but some traditions should be kept just because. How would you like it if you were Maria in The Sound of Music, and all the nuns there were wearing pantsuits and bell-bottoms? I could never wear bell-bottoms, though I've been told my bottom is bell-shaped. Yeah, most watched program in America for like 20 years, 60 minutes. I actually do like Andy Rooney, though, and I especially hope they keep him if he goes senile or gets Alzheimer's or something. I know, how could they tell? But it would be cool to watch his mind degenerate week by week. You'll watch 60 Minutes in the year 2007 and hear Leslie Stahl say, "And now a few minutes with Uncle Andy in the nursing home. Hi, Uncle Andy." Paper clips. Or staples. They both clip things. It's important to clip things. Staples are made of metal. Paper clips are made of hair. They use a lot of paper clips at CBS. Did I used to work there? I want my blue hat, Mommy. My green hat makes me look like a pickle. All right, enough ragging on Raggedy Andy. And it's just jealousy. I mean, who doesn't wish we had his job? Except I do have his job. 90 minutes of it, 7:30 to 9 every Sunday night on WGBB. Comedy, commentary, culture, music, and madness. Now last week, in a segment called Dave Goes Off, I did a whole rant about how national holidays that celebrate birthdays should be held on the birthday. For example, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday was January 15th, last Wednesday, and I railed against that and said, if you're trying to uphold the true meaning of an occasion, shouldn't it all kind of sort of fall in the 24-hour period that you're trying to honor? Well, I still feel that way a whole week later, and yet I'm going to be hypocritical and go back on my words because this Thursday, January 23rd, is my birthday, but I'm going to celebrate it on the radio today. So this is Dave's self-indulgent birthday show. I've been a good boy, and I'm giving myself a radio present. I'm Dave, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, theater critic, journalist, playwright, and 39 years old in 4 days. And my show is Sweet 16, 16 weeks old. Two reasons to celebrate. And we'll do it in much the usual way, with a mix of funny segments, serious talk, odd bits, and music. I will give my usual warning that although we're not out to shock or offend anybody, the show's humor and subject matter are for adults. So if you have children who might be listening, and you don't want them to be listening, kill them. Everybody else, thanks for tuning in. We'll begin right after this. Welcome back to the Dave's Gone By self-indulgent birthday show. My story begins in March or April 1963, when my dad, Philip Ian Lefkowitz, and my mom, Brenda Pia Lefkowitz, paid a visit to Mr. Stork. They said, "We love each other very much. Can you give us a baby?" And the stork said, "Oh, yes, you good people, you will be blessed. Now go home and have hot, steamy, unprotected sex and wait a few months. So that's exactly what they did. And on January 23rd, 1964, the day the poll tax on federal elections was repealed, I was born at Brooklyn Jewish Hospital at 5:49 p.m. My dad was 26 at the time. My mom was 21. Now, I asked my mom and dad if they wanted to help me reenact the delivery for the radio, but that did not work out. So instead, I got my best friend Scott and one of the engineers at the station, Joe Salzone, to help me out on this. Now, you have to imagine we're in Brooklyn Jewish Hospital 39 years ago. Engineer Joe will be playing my dad. My friend Scott is playing my mom. And I will make a cameo appearance as me. Okay, Engineer Paul, are we ready? Here we go. Let's see. Oh, radio theater coming through.
The date is January 23rd, 1964. You are a fly on the wall at Brooklyn Hospital. And what are we watching? David Lefkowitz's birth. We take you there now.
All right. Okay, Brenda, just keep pushing.
Stop!
Push.
Phil, why are you crying? Stop, stop crying and be helpful.
Mrs. Lefkowitz, just please push. Let's count.
You'll count.
Push. 10, 9, 8, 7.
7, 15,
It's all right.
Stop crying.
All right. I think the baby is starting to crowd.
Passing a football.
Right, just push hard. Push as hard as you can.
I'm going to faint.
Mr. Lefkowitz, she really needs your help.
You faint. I'll come running after you. Stop it.
That's just push harder. Oh, the head is out. Yeah, that explains a lot right there. Anyway, my name, David, wasn't originally on my birth certificate. It was added 2 weeks later by the registrar, and David was for a great-grandmother on my dad's side. Her name was Dina, so we kept the D, and my middle name, Neil, a stand-in for the Jewish name Naftali, which was in honor of my great-grandpa on my mom's side, Shapsa Hirsch Naftali. And much as I never liked the middle name Neil, it sure beat going through life as Shapsa Hirsch Naftali. And I did have some problems. I had a cleft palate and a hair lip. So people who accused me of having a hole in my head, well, I did, two of them. So they brought me home from the hospital, but then they brought me right back because I was, quote, failing to thrive. That was the phrase for it. I should have been growing, but I was losing weight and shriveling. And it didn't help that I couldn't nurse with my high lip. I couldn't clamp onto mommy's yummy fun bags. I can't believe I wrote this. Okay. Plus, I was allergic to milk. So I was really in Dutch until my doctor came up with a solution, both literal and tangible. He created a concoction called Meat Base, which was simply a formula whose initial ingredient was liquid meat. And by all accounts, it was absolutely disgusting. It was brown and glutinous, and it stank, and I loved it. I ate it like it was diarrhea ice cream. Pretty soon, I'm sorry, Engineer Paul. Pretty soon, I began to gain weight. And after a couple of months and all the operations, I finally got out of the hospital and began life at 320 Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn, New York. My parents were far from rich, but they gave me everything I wanted, and I'm still constantly reminded by the family of two infant memories. One, I could never keep my diaper on. As soon as I was changed, I would start running around the apartment, and within minutes, my diaper was on the floor, and I was cavorting about naked. This would get me into trouble in my teens, but we won't talk about that. The second memory is of being in my crib with all my toys, and I wouldn't get into the crib unless they were all there. But once I was in, I would toss them out, one by one, thud hitting the floor, until I picked which toy I wanted to sleep with. This would get me into trouble in my 20s, but we won't talk about that either. Anyway, I was a pretty solitary, insular kid. My two main activities when I wasn't reading or watching TV were either playing soccer, but I wasn't on any kind of team or on a field in the park. There were no fields. This was Brooklyn. We lived on the fourth floor of an apartment building, a lot of elderly people, retirees. So I would take the soccer ball, or I think I may have even used a volleyball, and I'd go into the hallway and just keep kicking it against the wall. And then I'd run around and go after it and got great exercise. But in retrospect, many of the other tenants on our floor, I mean, they were in their 70s, so half the day, the soccer ball would come rebounding off their doorways or bouncing along the halls. I'm really amazed one of them never came out and stuffed the ball down the incinerator and me after it. But I would play solo soccer, and also, when I got older, I was very influenced by Charlie Chaplin. Channel 13 was showing a series of all these silent movies, including Chaplin shorts from the SNA and Mutual period. And for some reason, he just became my absolute idol. I thought, that's it. Beyond film, create comedy, create pathos too, although at 8 years old, I doubt I used the word pathos, but I desperately wanted to be Chaplin. So I would take an old pool cue we had from a toy bumper pool set, and I put on my regular clothes and my big old clunky black shoes. I have extra wide feet, so I couldn't wear anything remotely comfortable or attractive. I put my shoes on the wrong feet, like the tramp, and I'd stay outside in the building's front area, and I think I even had a straw hat for a while. And I would just walk around with my hat and my misdirected shoes and my pool cue cane. I'd wander about right outside the building and make up silent movies in my head, little short films with me doing bits of comic business, which, in retrospect, must have looked really freaking weird to everyone passing by. It's starting to amaze me that my parents didn't just pack up one night and leave a note. You know, I wake up one morning on Lane 6 at the Avenue M bowling alley with a card pinned to my sleeve. You know, "Dear son, we could deal with the physical deformities, but now we're worried that you're insane. Please do not try to follow us, as we've already moved our belongings to an undisclosed location in Borough Park. We wish you well. You're obviously going to be one of those creative types. Hope you're not gay. Love, Mom and Dad." But no, Mom and Dad stuck it out, sent me to speech therapy at Brooklyn College, a wonderful lady named Mrs. Adler. She had to teach me to speak because having the cleft to make consonant sounds, I was using my sinuses or the back of my throat. She had to teach me where to put my tongue, which got me into trouble in my 30s, but we won't talk about that. Now, I want to give a little demonstration of what I was up against. If I wanted to sing the Noel Coward song, "You're the Top," it would sound something like this. "You're the top. You're the Colosseum. You're the top. You're the Louvre Museum. You're a melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a Fender Bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet. You're Mickey Mouse." So, of course, I had to use the new roof of my mouth and the front of my teeth, which eventually had braces for 10 years, to form words properly. As I've been told, I still have a bit of a lisp, or as speech people call it, a sibilant S. And I don't have an especially nasal voice, but then again, no one's going to confuse me with Chuck Scarborough. So, all this, and Hebrew school too. Bialik School, Hebrew Day School, on the aptly named Stone Avenue, Ocean Parkway, in Flatbush, Brooklyn. It was more than just your basic hour after public school that Jewish kids on Long Island. This was just shy of a yeshiva. It was an 8-hour day, half a day English, half a day Hebrew. I still think it's amazing that by third grade, I already had a longer, more intense school day than I would all through junior high school and, to some extent, high school. It was amazing. Bialik School, I would get there at 8:30, and I'd be there till 4:30 in the afternoon, with something like 45 minutes for lunch and, I think, a half-hour recess. And I'm like 7 years old, and I hate recess because I don't get along with any other kids. But then, when I'm 14, I get to junior high school in Long Island, and it's homeroom, 8:30, then class, then something called a free mod. and was a modular schedule made up of 20 or 40-minute mods. And if you had a free mod, you could go outside, go to the library. You couldn't linger in the halls, but it was free time. And you get, like, 5 of those a day, one of which you could use for lunch. And then 3:30 in the afternoon, boom. Unless you had detention or extracurricular activities, that was it. See you tomorrow. The irony is that we were all angling to get into good colleges, so we'd all be peer pressured into joining Spanish clubs and debate teams and math bees, so we wouldn't get home till 6:30 anyway. But still, I always wonder if I was better prepared for college by elementary school than I was by my secondary schools. Until I went to NYU, and college turned out to be more like junior high school anyway. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Bialik School, some good teachers, some bad ones. A few were smart people who just had no rapport with kids. These teachers' parents were Holocaust survivors who probably accustomed their children to boredom, screaming, and mental torture. But to be fair, I should say I was generally the teacher's pet. I was ridiculously quiet and well-behaved. I mean, even the most unpleasant teachers thought the sun rose from the top of my yarmulke, which definitely made school bearable, and I was straight A's, or straight Olives, all through elementary school. Although there were times when keeping up my Mr. Perfect image wasn't so easy. The worst I remember was during the holiday of Sukkot. We learned all the rituals, and the school had its own sukkah, a big patchwork shelter you go in during the holidays. The roof is all leaves and branches, so you can still see the sky through it, and you can decorate it with fruit and flowers and colorful things like that. So, they march in the school children on warm October days, pour out cups of grape juice and some fruit, and we sing Hebrew songs and learn about the holiday, which was fine. Except if you have fruit, and juice, and pictures of flowers, and teachers wearing bright colored dresses, you're going to have some other guests you didn't plan on. Now I wouldn't quite say phobic, but I'm certainly neurotic about flying, stinging insects. Bees, wasps, hornets, my panic reaction is, I admit, much greater than the actual threat, unless you step on a nest or something. So, the sight of a bee, especially when I was 9 years old, was enough to turn me clammy from head to toe, send my heartbeat racing, and basically put me in the adrenaline flight mode. Imagine, then, being in a sukkah with nearly a dozen bees, minding their own business, but still buzzing around, climbing the walls, crawling on the grape juice, trying to pollinate pictures of grapes, and me trying to sit there, silently, hands folded, and be ready to answer questions about the miracle of Jewish holidays. One time I remember, at the end of the year, near summer vacation, I was sitting in class and I felt a weird sensation in my hair. And I realized from the whispers around me that a bee was in the vicinity, with one kid next to me saying, "It's crawling on your yarmulke." And he wasn't being cruel, it really was. And the teacher, I think it was Mr. Gross, was like, "Don't move. If you stay still, he'll leave you alone and fly away." And after the longest 30 seconds of my life, he did. Which may have taught me the greatest lesson I ever learned in elementary school. Always carry spare underpants. No, just kidding. And now, here's a little more music for you.
Kids, I don't know what's wrong with these kids today. Kids, who can understand anything they say? Kids, they are disobedient, disrespectful oafs. Noisy, crazy, sloppy, lazy loafers. And while we're on the subject, kids, you can talk and talk till your face is blue. Kids, but they still do just what they want to do. Why can't they be like we were, perfect in every way? What's the matter with kids today? Kids! I don't mind the moonlight swims, it's the loop that hurts. Kids! How'll we ever beat the Russians? Kids! I didn't know what puberty was until I was almost past it.
Laughing, singing, dancing, grinning, morons. And while we're on the subject, kids, they are just impossible to control. Kids, with their awful clothes and their rock and roll. Why can't they dance like we did? What's wrong with Sammy Kay? What's the matter with kids today?
Now, that's a song I never heard until 3 days ago when I was preparing this program. Paul Lynde, pre-Hollywood Squares, from the Broadway original cast recording of Bye Bye Birdie. Which brings me to Ocean Parkway Jewish Day Camp. Yes, as prosaic as it sounds, it was like school, only without all the interesting learning stuff. Well, for me, anyway. My sole memory of Ocean Parkway Jewish Day Camp was one event being canceled because of rain, and then another time they were about to screen the movie of Bye Bye Birdie, and the projector broke down, which I think is probably for the best, because showing a bunch of 10-year-olds and Margaret would have jump-started puberty way too quick. And that was it, my only memory of day camp. I have other memories of Bialik. My wife is looking at me askance. I have other memories of Bialik School, but they're not all bad. The annual Sagers, Friday afternoons in Mr. Hannell's class playing word jumble. At the end of the week, we'd spend the last half of class unscrambling words. And I was like the Michael Jordan of word jumble. 80 to 90% of the time, my hand would go up first. And it got to the point where the other kids were growing frustrated, so he'd start throwing in math problems, too. And Gail got most of those, but it was fun. Oh, and I was school spelling champion. Yes, I was. They sent me to the Daily News Citywide Spelling Bee, but alas, I did not bring home Old Glory. I nearly went out on the word vanilla. Ironically, it's my favorite flavor. Two N's or two L's or just one L. I remember facing the moderator who asked me to spell it and going V-A-N-I-L-L-A. And he was like, are you asking me or telling me? And I said, I'm telling you. And I didn't say, thanks for the easy laugh at my expense, you smug little a-hole. I hope you get cancer and die. No, I just kept quiet and got the word right. But then the word souvenir, that one tripped me up. And no, I thought there was an L in it somewhere, like souvenir. And so ended my dreams of becoming spelling president of the universe. But my creative streak continued unabated. I enjoyed painting in art class, which is odd, because I'm not the type who likes to make a mess. I'm not phobic about it, but I was never one for mud puddles or checking the oil or squishing my hands in meatloaf. But painting, I liked, even finger painting, and I was terrible at it, which was fine, because I already knew that my real thing was going to be writing. And that had to be good, and it had to be clever, and sometimes shocking, and sometimes off the beam. My last memory of elementary school that I'll share was the librarians getting upset because I'd written something for the school newspaper or literary magazine or whatever. It was 6th or 7th grade, and by now we had been inundated with material about the Holocaust. We heard stories, watched films. People are worried about children getting into R-rated movies. We were 11 years old, watching piles of bodies being steamrolled into mass graves. And then we had kosher pizza. But anyway, Holocaust consciousness was big at that point. They mixed the whole victim psychology of everyone hates the Jews and we're never safe with, I must say, a strong dose of never again and Jews will always survive. So I wrote a satirical piece taking a side stab at Franklin Delano Roosevelt because somewhere I'd read that he knew about the death camps but chose not to bomb them, which made him a coward and an anti-Semite and everything else. And I also read that just before FDR died, he smiled and gave a little wave and then collapsed. So I put a line in my story about how the only thing Roosevelt was good for was smiling and waving and falling out of chairs. And I got a very gentle lecture about how I shouldn't make fun of handicapped people. Well, to think, 5 years later, I was writing parody songs about, let's see, women with no arms, children with Down syndrome, and victims of castration. Ah, my teen years on Long Island. But that's for later. Now it's time for the weekly feature, The News Gone By, a rundown of current events, and I do run them down, and we'll do that right after this. 8 o'clock, and yes, we've been on since 7:30. We're doing that now for a few weeks, 7:30 to 9 on Sunday nights, and now it's time for The News Gone By, a look at events of the past week from a 39-year-old perspective. Plus, we have a Sam Kinison moment and the obvious joke of the week. All in The News Gone By, starting now. At the top of the news, the drumbeat goes on between the U.S. and Iraq. On Thursday, U.N. weapons inspectors were searching a storage area and found 11 empty chemical warheads. They were in a sealed box, which was covered with dust and bird poop. An Iraqi liaison was quick to say that the box was listed in its 12,000-page weapons declaration. He said these empty warheads were, quote, no more than a storm in a teacup. In fact, the following week, they were getting ready to bring the box for evaluation on Iraq's popular television program, The Antique Weapons Show. Only the week before, three canisters of sarin gas were appraised at $250. It would have been more had the labels not been slightly torn and one of the canisters slightly open and covered with vomit and bile. With the closing of 326 Kmarts and AOL Time Warner in turmoil, it's hard to find happy business news, but here's something. Needix, the old hot dog and orange string stand, is back. Founded in 1910, they've been out of business since the early 80s, but the name Needix was bought by the Reese Organization, and now they've opened the stand on the 8th Avenue side of Penn Station. The venue had its official reopening on Wednesday, selling the classic Needix combo of an orange drink and a New York dirty water hot dog. I'm sure you know, that's not a phrase I'm making up. That's what they're called. It's even on the sign, albeit in quotation marks, and it ought to be in quotes, because actually, the Needix dogs they're selling are on a grill. I know, they're not in the famous dirty water, which refers to the pushcart vendors who keep wieners floating in a solution that probably starts as clean water, but by 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon already has the appearance of drain cleaner. But of course, dirty water hot dogs are the best in the world. And if they were sanitary, the snouts and the ears and the meat wouldn't have that extra kick. But seriously, I ate at the Needix this past week, and the franks are tasty, and the prices are good. You can get a fine dog for $1.50, and a monster with everything on it for $2.25. Considering this is in Penn Station, where ice cream is $3 a scoop, Needix is definitely on my good side price-wise. And no, this is not an advertisement. I just sometimes feel like complimenting what seems to be a good product at a fair price. I didn't try the waffle fries or the fabled orange drink, that's $1.50, but it's certainly there, as are 16 possible toppings for your Frankfurter. And if you find the 17th, you're standing too close to the homeless guy next to you. And for those a little more adventurous, the new store also has Texas corn dogs and the Chicago dog, which has basically everything piled on. I would avoid the Polish dog, which is served with the bun outside, and the Korean dog, which is tasty, but has depleted the city's population of schnauzers. Two different stories this week involving sheep. First, congratulations to Titus Adams, age 7, who won the annual Mutton Bustin' Contest in Eaton, Colorado. It's an event that's part of the National Western Stock Show and the Colorado State Fair. Mutton Bustin' is where kids who weigh less than 60 pounds see how long they can ride a sheep before being thrown off. There's a similar contest for adult men living in Appalachia, but the rules are different. You don't have to stay on the sheep, just in it. In more artistic news, British poet and artist Valerie Laws has been given a 2,000-pound grant to create random poems using 15 live sheep. Ms. Laws, a disabled mother of two, got the sheep from a local farmer. She then spray-painted words on them, and in the months ahead, she'll be watching them move around the platform to see what new poems they create. Said the poet in an interview, randomness and uncertainty is at the center of how the universe is put together, and it's quite difficult for us as humans who rely on order. So I decided to explore the principles of quantum mechanics through poetry using the medium of sheep. She already wrote one poem, a haiku, which is a traditional Japanese verse form of 3 lines and 17 syllables. What she didn't realize was that at night, the sheep themselves came up with a haiku, especially for her. It read, "Woman with spray can thinks she can push us around. Tomorrow, she dies." And speaking of homicidal animals and poetry, how's this for poetic justice? A rooster, about to be set loose for a cockfight in the Philippines, instead attacked his handler. The bird had razor-sharp steel spikes strapped to its legs, which it dug into the man's thigh and groin, started bleeding profusely, and died on the way to the hospital. Ironically, what may have cost him his life was a delay when the ambulance first came. The technicians saw that he was bleeding, but when they heard him scream, "Oh no, my cock is out of control," nobody went near him. Yeah, we're still on the air. Okay, on the weather front, it's been cold all week in New York, but we've had it easy compared to South Asia. According to the Associated Press, 986 people in northern India, Nepal, and Bangladesh have died from a month-long cold snap. Winters there are usually brief and mild, but this time, temperatures have been staying in the low 40s Fahrenheit. That would feel almost balmy here, but we're talking about millions of people without heat, electricity, or warm clothing. Schools are being closed, blankets are being distributed on the streets, emergency measures are being taken, which leads me to this week's Sam Kinison moment. Just a little moment of Zen rage that's thoroughly logical, yet willfully uncomprehending. So, you have millions of people living in the Himalayas, where fierce winds are whipping off the mountains and bringing the chill factor down to zero all day and night. And it's been that way for weeks now. Makes you wonder why the Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee doesn't just go to these people and say, "You know, all your clothing is flimsy, and your houses have no insulation, and your bodies just aren't accustomed to cold weather. Oh, sure, you could stay and freeze to death, but here's a novel idea. Why don't you move where the sun is? If you were freezing 2 weeks ago, and you're still freezing this week, and it's only January, what do you think the weather will be like next week, Pasadena? Get a clue. When the dot on your head turns from red to purple, it's time to get the hell out. Oh, oh!" And that's the Sam Kinison moment for this week, January 19th, brought to you as a public service by Dave's Gone By. Going to science news, now orbiting the Earth is the space shuttle Columbia. On it is Ilan Ramon, Israel's very first astronaut. An Air Force colonel and former fighter pilot, Ramon is being hailed by his countrymen, who waved flags and turned up 300 strong for the launch. Asked by reporters why he wanted to go into space, Ramon replied, "Why shouldn't I want to go into space?" Told it might be dangerous, Ramon answered, "What do you mean dangerous?" Asked if there were any specific experiments he would perform in space, Ramon said, "Yes, we're going to try to fix problems with the ozone layer by bombarding it with heavy doses of guilt." Speaking of which, in music news, rock star Pete Townshend was officially placed under arrest, his computer confiscated, pending investigation of his downloading of child pornography from the Internet. The singer, songwriter, and guitarist was interrogated by police for more than an hour, and he promised to return for further questioning later this month. Now, last week, Townshend tried unsuccessfully to ward off police inquiries by releasing a statement. He admitted paying for kiddie porn, but only because he was doing research for his autobiography. Now, there may be something to that, as his book is tentatively titled Nursery School Hookers. But seriously, with the scandal not going away, Townshend then launched another salvo in the press, trying to explain his position. Unfortunately, that position still seemed to be missionary. And Townshend was having about as much luck clearing his name as Trent Lott would have trying to join NWA. But the Who guitarist hasn't given up. He very quickly wrote and recorded a song stating his point of view and trying to win back favor with the public, much as one imagines John Lennon did when he penned the Ballad of John and Yoko. Now, I don't know if it's going to work for Pete. Musically, the song is a rather atypical number for the Who legend, but we're lucky enough to have a copy here. We only have the vocal track. The other musicians aren't on this demo tape, but it's still quite a find, and I doubt it's been played anywhere else on American radio, so I'm really excited. Engineer Paul, if we can cue that up, please. Here is the Ballad of Pete Townshend.
For little girls are small in every way. Thank heaven for little boys. You can look at them with lust and not be gay. When I was just a lad, I was molested. That's why I like them small and thimble-breasted. Thank heaven for little girls, for leading boys like me astray. Don't call me a pedophile, or judge me by the websites that I join. It's normal to be beguiled by the fuzz upon an adolescent groin. A toddler in a Speedo knocks me socks off. Just watching Teletubbies gets me rocks off. Thank heaven for little girls, and naked baby bodies on display. Thank heaven for preteen porn. The internet is full of newborn flesh. And please don't treat me with scorn, 'cause once they turn 13 the smell's not so fresh. When I get me a towel to put me sperm in, I do like Jeffrey Jones and Pee Wee Herman. Thank heaven for little girls, for blowing boys like me away. Thank heaven for little girls, their bottoms are just perfect for a spank. There's nothing in all the world like reading Little Women when I... Wait a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, as a member of the WHO, I have been in the public eye for 40-odd years. Aren't I entitled to a little privacy? A little private time between me and me hard drive? It's just research to fight sexual abuse of children. You have to think like a pervert. As my music teacher once told me, if you want to play the violin, you got to fiddle around a bit. Fiddle around a bit, he said. So ladies and gentlemen, I ask you, indulge a creative person, an artist. When I ram the neck of me Gibson Les Paul into an amp and make a big hole, that's just sublimation of your desires, ain't it? And do you really think I could do that windmill move on the guitar if I didn't spend hours practicing on something else? Young ladies are heaven sent. I keep them after school for a pop quiz. They finger me instrument, and when they're done I fill them up with joy. I would have sold a pot of golden rubies to make a mess on prepubescent boobies. Thank heaven for little girls, for pinball's not the only game they play. The kids are all...
Yes, the kids are all right indeed. Pete Townsend there on the Dave's Gone By show. Continuing the news gone by on the local front, former Hofstra University employee Thomas Stewart was sentenced to a fine and 3 years probation for changing the grades of 37 students at the school. Using a password, Stewart logged on to the school's computer system and raised students' grades in such courses as history, English, and earth science, all except introduction to Polish, where he changed A's and A-minuses to D's. By the way, I don't know why we have two Polish jokes in the news this week. We just do. In medical news, according to a study at Boston Hospital and the Harvard School of Public Health, too many surgeons are leaving their patients a little something to remember them by. Out of 800 operations studied, 1,500 resulted in metal instruments and other debris being left inside people's bodies. The high number of accidents isn't attributed so much to fatigue as unexpected complications and distracting emergencies. And the Associated Press notes that the accidents, and this is a quote, also happen more often to fat patients, simply because there is more room inside them to lose equipment. As a quote, lost most often were sponges, but metal clamps and electrodes were also hot items in the lost and found. Surprisingly, only one patient died of complications. Other patients only became aware of the mistake because they happened to visit the doctor for something else entirely. And still more didn't even need surgery to void the object. No celebrities were part of the study, although actor Harvey Fierstein has volunteered for the next. He plans to undergo colonic surgery, and just to be on the safe side, he's brought a wide variety of extra objects. From sex, we go to violence. Remember last week's idiot of the year? The guy at the Afghani wedding who kicked a grenade because he wondered why it didn't explode? Well, we have an American equivalent this week, not quite so retarded, but just as dead. A 25-year-old rookie police officer shot himself by accident while handling a new weapon. According to the New York Post, quote, the cop was hit in the head with a single shot from a 39 caliber revolver he had just purchased. Only minutes earlier, he had been playfully showing off the weapon to fellow officers in the locker room of the Greenwich Village Station House, unquote. He was rushed to St. Vincent's Hospital but arrived DOA. The officer will receive full police honors at his funeral. Although his family is upset about one little change, he'll still get the ritual 21-gun salute, but the guns will be aimed at a big red and white target on the side of his casket. Another strange death to report, plus our obvious joke of the day. From London comes news of Boyd Taylor, a 36-year-old man who built a homemade guillotine and then used it on himself. According to Reuters, he used a timer to activate the device, which worked. Taylor was found by his father, who was shocked at the scene. Said Mr. Taylor, "I always thought the boy was headstrong. Guess he wasn't." That was the obvious joke of the day, brought to you as a public disservice by WGBB. Finally, in the arts news, Connecticut Stamford Center for the Arts will be presenting a performance art piece that fuses spoken word and poetry. Opening this Thursday, the show is called Spusic, which is easily the most unappetizing combo word since weathermen came up with snain and airlines gave out sporks. As for the speech and music in Spusic, I haven't seen the show. They say it will be shocking and a hit, which together makes it a piece of hawking. And that's the news gone by for January 19th, 2003. Your comments and opinions are Spusic to my ears, so please send them to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062, or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. Please, no mutton busting. I'm too sheepish. And if you're just... Oh, I don't know if I was on mic then, but it's 8:18, and if you're just tuning in, the show now airs 7:30 to 9 p.m. on Sundays. We were 8 to 9, but we recently added an extra half hour. That might not be permanent, but for the time being, we have a full 90 minutes, so tell your friends. 7:30 to 9 Sunday nights on WGBB. I'm the host of Dave's Gone By, Dave Lefkowitz, and I turn 39 years old on Thursday the 23rd. Time then to consider the continue the saga of my existence on this, my self-indulgent birthday show. So, aside from the usual things we do on this eclectic program, I'm wallowing in a bit of autobiography. In the first half hour, we went rather graphically through my birth and childhood, my years in Hebrew school, the shaping of my demented personality. I left out the hernia, I had one of those, and then a couple of years ago I had another one of those. Although the second time, they didn't have to do what they did the first time, which was bring one of my testicles down from its perch somewhere in my abdomen. When my dog Murray was neutered a couple of months ago, he had the same situation. One of his nuts was undescended, and the vet had to go in and bring it down. Only in Murray's case, of course, she yanked it down and hacked it off, along with his other one. My testicles were, thank God, left intact, and they weren't taken from me until 5 years ago, but we'll talk about marriage another time. I'm kidding, honey, I'm sorry. She's in the control room, and she's got a knife. So where were we? Oh yeah, onward to junior high school. I was 12 and a half years old studying for my bar mitzvah, and my dad and mom finally said to themselves, you know, Brooklyn is changing. The neighborhood's getting a little unpleasant. Plus, we're paying rent to a landlord. His name was Jeremias, by the way. Our landlord won't even keep our bathroom ceiling from falling down. What about a house? It was 1976, and middle-class houses on Long Island's South Shore certainly cost more than a two-bedroom apartment, especially when you had to pay for your own heat and electric and shovel snow and do the gardening and commuting, etc. But the good side was that a house was something you owned. And if the mortgage didn't work out, you could generally turn around and sell it for a little more than the $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 you paid for it. Back then, who knew? So thank goodness my folks took the leap, and we moved at the end of seventh grade. And I remember I was given two options for my bar mitzvah, a trip to Israel, or a big party at beautiful Leonard's of Great Neck. Why I chose the party, I'll never know. But I had the same lousy time I usually have at big parties, although I was happy with the color scheme I selected, brown. After that, I really shut the door on Brooklyn and that horrible kind of music. I was sick of my rigid Jewish education. I had only one or two real friends back in elementary school, so it was shalom and good riddance to everyone else. I needed to make a break, physically and emotionally. And here I was in a house, an actual house, with a backyard and a basement and a bedroom that was, believe it or not, smaller than the one I had in the apartment. But who cared? There was a den, a storage room, a living room where I'd soon be practicing piano, and public school that was easier than private. Still had trouble making friends, still had more than a few sleepless nights over which bullies were waiting for me the next day. Though I definitely had a guardian angel, as far as that was concerned. An avenging angel, too. I ended up making friends who had other friends who looked out for me. and I don't know why, but messing with me turned out to be real bad karma for a couple of bullies. One kid who lived down the block and gave me a hard time, he wasn't the worst. When he got a little older, he tried LSD and jumped off the roof of his house. A few years after they buried him, the house burned to the ground. I had nothing to do with it, but the mills of God grind slowly. And worst bully I had, a kid named Tom, also lived a block away, and he was on my school bus. And he was a wild piece of garbage. 15 years old, and he dyed his hair and shaved it into a mohawk 3 years before anybody on Long Island heard of punk rock. But he wasn't a punk rocker, he was just a punk, and he made my life absolute hell. And then, several years later, after I heard he'd done some prison time, I ran into him on the street, and I didn't recognize him at first, because he was wearing a dress. True story. Messing with Dave is a bad thing. So, any listener contemplating complaining about my show or writing nasty letters to the station, please be warned. My karma can kick your karma's ass. And will. But enough dwelling on the negative. I also had a lot of fun in those early teen years, junior high and high school. I'd wait with excited anticipation for a creative writing class. I took a Super 8 film class with the wonderful Mr. Dunn. I enjoyed chess club. Yes, I know. I know. Chess club. Which I liked a hell of a lot more than math and science club, which I did because I still had fanciful dreams of getting into Harvard or Yale. Ha. And I took a theater class to get over my very deeply ingrained shyness. My tastes were changing, and my personality was changing, and my goals were changing, and quite a lot of that had to do with one person, a short, curly-haired, high-spirited schoolmate named Scott. He was in 7th grade, I was in 8th, and when we met, when we first met, we hung with different people, had completely different family experiences, and wildly divergent tastes and ideas. But on one thing, we agreed, and the name of that one thing was Bob. And welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Dave here with my very best friend in the world. Well, okay, except my wife, but you know what I mean. My best male friend, my best male member of my entourage. No, I better not. Well, anyway, his name is Scott, Scott Rogalitz, and we have been pals since junior high school. Hello, Scotty.
Hey, Dave.
And...
just it's 77 or 78. It must have been, it was late 77.
Probably 77.
77, yeah.
Like,
you're after my bar mitzvah. That's right.
And we were at Junior High School South.
No, Woodmere Junior High South, which no longer exists. They knocked it down and built the...
these horrible-looking condos?
Condos, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, how did we first sort of meet, or when did you become aware of my depraved existence?
You were a sort of bizarre fringe character.
It wasn't to me, but...
No. Amazing, right? But, you had moved to the neighborhood from another school, and you didn't know a lot of people in the district, in our school district.
Right, I was from,
people in the neighborhood.
From Brooklyn,
right, from Brooklyn, exactly. I had grown up in Woodmere. I was born and raised in Woodmere. And you used to sit at a desk in the school library... that had no other seat. They had those carrels, you know, where people would sit, several people to a carrel or whatever.
Right.
And you sat at the only table that no one else could sit at. So you had one seat, and it was just you there. And it was sort of a rather bizarre thing. Every time people, you know, if you'd walk in the library during that free period, you'd be sitting at that table, and no one else could really come near you. You know, you wrote for the school newspaper.
Oh, I was already
the South Chronicle at that point. Right,
yeah.
South Chronicle. You wrote for the newspaper. So I knew that you wrote for the newspaper. And I used to see you all the time in the library, and I was curious who is this person?
Who is this freak?
Right, was this strange? Oh, honestly, yeah, I wouldn't say freak, but who is this kind of strange kid who doesn't talk to anybody, is writing for the newspaper, and you were writing good things. I remember the thing before that was you had written an essay that they brought every class in the whole school about man's inhumanity to man.
Yep.
You wrote an essay, Man's Inhumanity to Man. And every single class, one by one, was wrote. Well, you, and you had to read the essay aloud. Probably, what, like 20 times?
Six or seven during the course of a day.
Right.
I started laughing in the middle of it by the end of the day because it just, you know, the words started to seem bizarre to me after a while. Yeah.
I remember that. I remember you had written this essay.
Right. And my folks actually have it framed in our basement wall, the actual speech on a long piece of paper.
totally amazing. Actually, I should
read that on the air, but okay. For another, maybe not. Since I'm much more pro inhumanity.
I don't know if you would agree with that. If you'd espouse the same opinion in this day and age. But I one day walked over to the table that you were sitting at and asked you what you were looking at. And you were looking at a book about Bob Dylan.
Right.
And I mentioned something about Bob Dylan, and you said that you really like Bob Dylan. I mentioned something, I like Bob Dylan also. And you were trying to basically shoo me away. You were like, all right, okay. Right.
Well, I thought that you were going to be picking on me or you know, making fun of me or going in some bad direction on that.
Right, well, there were some kids that picked on you. That was taken care of very shortly afterwards. When
right.
Jay Auerfeld, wherever you are, God bless you.
Yeah, well, we know where he is. He's in
upstate New York. But if you're they're out there hearing this somehow, the sound of my voice, Jay Auerfeld, God bless you. Jay took care of that. We'll get to that, I guess, in a moment. So I came up and started speaking to you, and we talked about Bob Dylan. And what I did was I asked you if you had Bringing It All Back Home, I think, was the album.
Right.
It was either Bringing
No, I was asking you because I didn't. We traded. I think I had Blood on the Tracks or something.
Right, you
like
had Blood
that.
On the Tracks, and I had either Bringing It All Back Home or.
And Highway 61.
And Highway 61. And you didn't have one or the other of
right.
them. So I brought them to you, and you were pretty amazed that somebody just came in and brought these records. And,
right.
You know, so,
and someone who knew Dylan, because I had
right.
been taping his songs off the radio, but I didn't have
right,
most
didn't
of
have
his albums or anything.
I
like
have
that.
All older brothers, so I was brought up, I cut my eye teeth. On, I think as Jeff Roth said in a previous interview, when Jeff saw me first, I was wearing a Velvet Underground,
yep.
a Velvet Underground jacket. When I was a little kid, my brother Jerry, who now lives in Asia, was a member of the private club at Max's Kansas City. And Harry Smith, the famous ethnomusicologist, was a very good friend of my brother's. And my brother was part of the Late Beat Poet group.
Yeah.
And all of his poetry is in the Fales Library, NYU Fales Library collection. They bought his original manuscripts. But the point I'm making is that as a little kid, at the age of three, maybe four, I was a child who was brought into I would go with him to Max's Kansas City.
Wow.
And I saw when the Velvet Underground for 1 month was a house band.
So you were physically present?
Oh, yeah, I was present when the Velvet Underground was.
You were the exploding plastic inevitable.
Well, yeah, in a sense, I have very little recall except a lot of loud noise and a lot of very strange people. And to me, it was like wild and freaky, cool kind of thing. My father did not find it funny, rest his soul, that I knew the lyrics to the song Heroin at the age of three, but, you know.
Well, you put an E on the end of it, so I thought it was about a woman of some sort.
He knew exactly. But it was, in any case, though, yeah. So I had a lot of albums of different, you know, because I grew up, my brothers, I grew up in a house with all this kind of music, and I had all these albums, this kind of stuff, and so I lent you these records, and then we started hanging out, and we became friends after that.
That was good. Yeah, and then we started doing skits, and we started doing...
Well, yeah, that was a whole... Right,
it wasn't that much later.
No, we both found that we both loved Monty Python.
Right. That's right, I forgot about that.
And what we started doing was writing our own skits together.
Mm-hmm.
And recording them.
On 8-track tapes, because I got a recordable 8-track deck.
Right, that's right. So exactly, yes. And then we also filmed on Super 8 film of me and your dad, of me doing something and me singing around the pool table.
Oh, yeah.
I was dressed up as a mafiosa dancing around the
pool. Well, I was already thinking about making movies when
that's right.
And I was doing Super 8 film and a sound film
that's
on
right.
Super 8. And then the video revolution came and we also incorporated all these friends into some of the things we were doing there.
Right, that's a videotape that actually still exists, Homegrown Films. I found that. I have the original.
Oh, wow,
tape.
Yeah.
That goes back to before pre-79, 78, 79. Everybody we knew. Basically, at that time, people who not even alive anymore.
Who?
Ezra Lebowski.
Now, what happened to him?
He committed suicide, unfortunately.
Okay.
But I mean, there were ex-girlfriends of my brothers had did guest spots on that. You weren't in every one of them. There was a whole Jacques Tweedy epic,
right.
Which as kids we wrote about a guy who promotes abortion and who's murdered But we wrote different.
David Genn,
Genn was in it, who's now a gastroenterologist, a doctor. But we did all these different skits, little quick skits. Bob Reinhold, the playwright, who was a very close friend of my family's, was in a skit where he played a Nazi war criminal who was being interviewed.
What was his name?
I don't remember the name, but I remember the only thing I remember about that. But I remember that he kept talking about a bank, the Deutsche Allgemeinische Bank, or MZ.
We'll do a whole segment about Bob at some point because
I have recordings. I have actual vocal sound recording of Bob. I have, of course, bobbing into it. Well, no, the video is gone. There was only one video, and it got lost somewhere along the line.
You're kidding me.
No. But in any case...
Okay. let's push this forward into also the music thing, because this is going to be really important to my life and stuff. You were... Well, just tell about the basic origins before me of the group, the Fishheads.
Well, I think you were pretty much there from the beginning.
No, because wasn't the...
Yes, the gong show, right.
Yeah, before it was Woodmere, musical, okay, really. Right.
Woodmere Junior High School South had, in 1979, fall 78, spring 79, we had a principal who was like a little, I don't know, she was like overly... friendly to the, overly nice to the students, which just made us completely, we were completely crazy.
This is Barbara Cole?
Yes, Barbara Cole. She's very, very cool. And as a result, she had two deans who were trying to keep order, Dr. McLeod and Mr. Stone.
McLeod, Roy McLeod, and
Dan Stone. And they tried to maintain order. It was completely impossible, considering the kids, all the people that we hung out with, Jay and what, you know. I remember Jay hanging from we'd go into the theater. There was no way to keep us out of the theater. They didn't lock it when we were in there. And the big, it's huge, like, I mean, it was like a real-sized theater. It was a tremendous theater.
Uh-huh.
And Jay would climb up the curtains, like 20 feet in the air, swinging, you know, and things like, you know. And he'd be in the basement, you know, there was, the famous time Mike Ballin called, Mike called in a bomb scare and it got blamed on Jay and all these, all of these things.
Which is ironic, but usually Jay would walk away clean.
That was one, but Jay got caught for it because he didn't do it. But this is this kind of thing. It was complete bedlam. And that year, they were having a gong show, and myself, Glenn Wiener, who we have no idea whatever became of Glenn Wiener. If anyone knows whatever became of Glenn Wiener from Hewlett after 1979, but Glenn Wiener...
Danny X. Schoen.
Danny wasn't part of that. Well, Danny was a friend of ours, but Danny wasn't part of that group. It was me, Glenn Wiener, and Mark Levin.
Oh, okay, right.
And we rehearsed the Bruce's skit from Monty Python. You know, hey, Emmanuel Kent was a real...
I wasn't part of this.
You weren't. Okay. And Stephen Fish... who was a dear friend of ours, got up on stage and acted as he was conducting us. And we were in funny hats and clothing, and we went this thing. We didn't win the gong show. We didn't get gonged. We came in second place, whatever.
Cool.
Yeah, second place out of a bunch of acts. Most of them were gonged. But in any case, that was the beginning of it. Then we decided to actually form a rock band. And we... I think you and I wrote the lyrics to the Enema Blues.
You came up with the idea of a song called Enema Blues.
And you wrote the lyrics.
Yeah. Because when I heard that, and I had never really, not since Hebrew school, had I written a song.
Right.
And then I heard that, I was like, Enema Blues. Oh, my God.
And you called me one day and said, I wrote a song called the Enema Blues. And I said,
It was 45 minutes after we had been on the phone, and we were talking about the band and all this. And wouldn't it be cool to have a song? We're thinking about the Enema Blues. And I think you even played... just a basic blues riff.
Right.
And so I got the Enema Blues. And there was nothing else to it. And then I said, okay, I'll talk to you later. And I called you back in like 45 minutes, and I had the song.
You had written it on the piano. That's right.
Right,
you'd gone down to the piano and you'd written it.
And then, boom. And the beauty part of that for me was that just opened up the floodgates. Because I started writing... song after song that year.
Week there'd be a new 3-4 song parodies of famous songs that you wrote the music
originals, everything, and eventually some serious songs too.
But we did, but the Enema Blues went with us through every incarnation of our bands, from the Fishheads through the regrouping of the Fishheads when we played at the Tempo Youth Center. There was a fire in the middle of our act.
Oh, yeah.
Everything started on fire, which we didn't cause. I mean, it was just,
What was our country band thing?
Red River Rodelets and the Pork Rinds. Yes.
Yep, we did it then.
And we played it. That song followed all the way through the Moist Sheep.
The Moist Sheep
was our biggest band. We actually played at what used to be the Rio Theater, and it's since... closed down on Rockaway Avenue, I think it was, in Valley Stream,
right?
They gutted it. They built a park there. We played. In fact, we have a photograph where it says Moist Sheep Music Show, and the week before is listed Sam and Dave. So it's a Sam and Dave Moist Sheep Music Show. We were on the same,
and we were about the last things there. I mean, Joan Jett played there just before the end.
We played there, and Sam and Dave were canceled for lack of ticket sales, and we went on anyway. Whoa. Which is, I mean, really sad, because Sam and Dave were...
Yeah, but they probably sold phenomenal. More tickets than us. We just kind of, we said, we're going to play, no matter
what.
Yeah,
I mean, when we made up for what we didn't sell tickets, everybody, like, reached in their pockets and paid for the tickets ourselves. Otherwise, Jay's like, there goes my bar mitzvah money! He's crazy, you know?
Of course, this was years after, well, he had already been.
Oh, no, years ago, yeah. I mean, this is, yeah, this is, well, it was 84, and, you know, we played at the Rio Theater in 84. That was our biggest, that was the show, 84.
Yeah. Well, I we'll get to Even the Moist Sheep another time, because that's a 10 stories and a half. I want to end it sort of with the Fish Heads. Were there any more amazing stories from that very first band when I joined and we started doing all these parody songs?
Yes. You didn't make the first show. You got flu the first show.
I go on record saying I really did have a bad cold that night. I wasn't faking it.
No, you got flu. We went on stage. The band that was supposed to open for us was called Just Another Band from L.A., named after the Zappa
album. Yeah. Album.
Jay Auerfeld, who later became one of our best friends,
of course, yeah,
and the rhythm guitar player for us, was at that time the guitar player for Just Another Band from L.A. And they opened for us. We were the Fish Heads was the lead act that night, although we sung about half of one song, and that was the end of the show, and then they came back on. And what happened was, you couldn't make it, you got sick. Our drummer and the bass player had no idea how to play bass.
Yeah, I mean, it was tremendously under-rehearsed. It was kind of like...
It was under-rehearsed. I mean, nobody knew any... I mean, Phil Gershwin got it. Oh, this is really what happened.
Uh-oh.
Phil Gershwin, everybody, we come out on stage. Phil Gershwin sits down at his keyboard. We start playing, and we're playing your song, which is a parody in 1064 called When I'm 93.
Right.
That's what we begin to play.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Okay, it's a parody about really old people, but to the tune of When I'm 64. Our bass player, Mike Ballin, who did not know how to play the bass. We had taught him the two notes, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Right. So, and he's wearing a conquistador's helmet. Okay. So Mike begins to play boom, 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 boom. At which point, Philip Gershwin starts playing the melody on the piano, because Philip knew how to play the piano. And he leans forward, something was improperly grounded, and he gets an electrical shock in his eye. And he falls backwards, and was rendered either unconscious or something like that. He was rendered so that he didn't do any of the rest of the show. Okay, the drummer is disgusted by the fact that nothing's... The drummer, Mike Robbins, who knew how to play the drum, gets up and walks off the stage. I then walk back and kick his drum kit over. Our bass player, Mike Ballin, realizes this isn't going well and walks off the stage.
Right.
Still on the floor. Who was playing guitar? Wait a minute. I don't even remember who was the guitar player at the time. But in essence, the entire thing went... The audience went completely crazy. We started throwing things at each other.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, things started beginning... Everything was on the stage. There was a lot of... Oh, Glenn Wiener was with us. And things began to get thrown from the audience to the stage, from the stage back to the audience. And right away, the curtain was closed. Mr. Stone ran up and said, you know, I'm going to nail you guys to the wall. And the curtains were closed. And, you know, right away they brought back Just Another Band from L.A., and Jay said, I want to join your group. Which is very, and that's what happened. But that night, somebody who was very in an overzealous mood took a Bic pen and pulled the head off it. So it was just that kind of stick, the tube-like stick of ink.
Yeah.
Blowing into the stick of ink.
Yeah.
And wrote the word fish heads in thick ink on the floor of the theater. And Mr. Stone walked in it.
Oh, no.
And so he, next thing we know, he grabs a hold of me and Jay. I don't know why exactly, because Jay wasn't even a member of the band. Maybe Philip Gershwin, too. And I think Glenn Wiener also, and he says to us, you know, he gets us these containers of Zep cleanser. You know, some kind of,
or Zud,
you
know, or something.
Zud.
Yeah,
Zud.
Something Zud. Yeah.
Zud. Zud cleanser. And he tells us that, you know, you guys are going to clean this. So... We start. Jay doesn't. Jay says, "I'm not going to do this." Jay takes the containers and starts pouring Zud, you know, powder all over the floor and smear. You know, just, and Mr. Stone comes walking back and just sees somebody else has climbed to the top of the curtains and is swinging. And you know, everybody's, something was going on. I don't know what. Somebody was smoking in the theater. And it's just, all of you just go home, forget about it. So I guess the custodians had to take care of it. But it was quite a ruckus. I mean, after that, we were never allowed to play on the stage. Although they let us the next year. After we had graduated, we were in the high school. In those days, ninth grade was 7th, 8th, 9th. 10th grade was high school.
Right. 7th, 8th, 9th was the junior high school at that point.
Right. So they let us the next year. We came, I don't know how, still Mrs. Cold. They let us come back and play the next year.
And that was a real cut. We really did
the gig. Yes, and John DiResta, of all people, who went on to have the TV show DiResta.
Right.
And become a relatively famous comedian.
Well, he's at Caroline's all the time, right, and places like that.
John DiResta opened, he announced us. He came on the stage and announced ladies and gentlemen, you know, and he, you know, he was, John was a, I wouldn't say a very close, John was a good friend of Jay's, I think, but John was there. I mean, so there were all these strange satellite-like things of people were involved in this,
well,
this madness.
This madness is just part one of, I hope, many, many more reminiscing madnesses to come in future weeks as I talk more to my great, great good friend, and I'm so proud to have him as a friend.
Thank you very much, Dave. The feeling is absolutely mutual, and I'm very proud to have... I'm very glad that Dave's Gone By is on the radio. It gives me something wonderful to listen to on the radio, because I had basically decided that the radio had was absolutely dead. So, I generally don't turn the radio on. This is true. Other than to listen to your program, we don't turn the radio on.
Well, aw, shucks. Well, love to your wife, Tanya, and
your
beautiful baby, Yelena.
Thank you very much.
And
Joyce.
Thank you. And thank you, Scott Rogalitz.
Thank you very
much for being with me on Dave's Gone By.
Thank you.
My baby went and left me. She's gone without a doubt. But even worse than that, you know, she really cleaned me out. I got the air of my blues. Have a sense with her past. You know, she flushed out my whole life. Now she's trying to flush out my heart. I thought that I was good to her. I never treated her mean. I even let her use my bathroom. And now she's flushed me clean. I got the animal blues. Ever since we've been apart. You know, she flushed out my whole life. Now she's trying to flush out my heart. She ran off with my bowling shoes, my car, my dog, and my kid. I told her,
blow it out my ass.
And that's exactly what she did. I got the air of my blues.
Woo-hoo.
Ever since we've been apart. You know she flushed out my whole heart. Now she's trying to flush out my heart.
One more time,
one more time. You know she flushed out my whole heart. Now she's trying to flush out my heart.
Dan Stone, wherever you are.
We're back with Dave's Gone By. It's 8:47, getting to the end of my birthday show, and I'm just starting into my teen years. But I'm not going to rush through everything. I'd rather save other stories and anecdotes for next year, when, God willing, I'll see the big 4-0. So for now, I'll backtrack to high school, where I was definitely coming out of my shell. I not only took another theater class, but in my senior year, I auditioned for and got a role in the spring high school play, Neil Simon's Come Blow Your Horn. It's the story of two brothers, one of whom is living free and easy bachelorhood in New York. The other is meek and nerdy and still lives with his parents, and he'll dutifully go into their father's business selling waxed fruit. I came out and did my prepared monologue, nervous as all get out, and also read from the play. I really thought it was good enough, even typecast as the spineless, unassuming younger brother. And the director then had everyone who auditioned do some improv and asked me if I could play Yosemite Sam, of all people, which I did. I squatted down, index fingers in the air like pistols, saying, "Are you varmint?" or something equally ingenious. And before I knew it, I was cast, not as the bashful, lovable younger brother, but as the raging, tyrannical, beleaguered, old-fashioned dad, the part played by Lou Jacoby on Broadway and Lee J. Cobb in the movie. Say what you will about Rolling Stone magazine's perception reality campaign, but if ever I got a wake-up call about who I thought I was and what other people thought of me, that was it. That and the time in college I wasn't cast in the Sam Shepard play Seduced because I was too short. They didn't tell me in words, but they stood me up between the play's two actresses, both a head taller than me, and I literally felt short. To this day, I hope that show was a flop and they all died of cancer. But I'm not bitter. And rejection's part of the game when you take an artistic path, and it was that road I chose later in high school. The theater, Come Blow Your Horn, was a hit. The homemade movies, a video class, the songs I wrote, the bands I was in. By the time I reached senior year, I knew I wasn't going to be a teacher, or just a teacher, or any kind of lawyer, or business dude, or ologist. And I had that fateful moment every Long Island Jewish kid both dreads and anticipates, telling his parents that the next four incredibly expensive years of college won't prepare him for anything in real life except... well, no, anything. and to my mom and dad's everlasting credit, they supported me in that decision. They needed, or they knew that I needed, to go out and do my thing and spread my Dave-ness to a world they prayed was ready to listen, or at least a world that wouldn't smash my wooden cart and send me to Siberia. So, on the advice of counsel, well, guidance counselor, I sent out 3 college applications, Harvard, Yale, and New York University. I figured, shoot for the best, the most prestigious places, and if they say no, my safe school is probably the finest for creative stuff anyway. And I remember my interviews from the Ivy League schools. The Yale woman was very nice, but the Harvard guy was this balding, middle-aged man who lived in the neighborhood. He wore tweed and smoked a pipe, which I guess made him fancy himself some kind of experimental psychologist. And the 2 things I remember most about our interview was that it didn't go well, and that we spent the first 2 minutes deciding which chair I would sit in. He had several chairs strategically placed around the room, and it became a kind of cognitive test which one I would finally sit in. I guess I chose the wrong one because I didn't get into Harvard or Yale, bastards. To this day, when I see college football scores, I root against both of them. I'll never put a Yale lock on my door, and never, ever will I eat pudding hastily. But NYU, whatever disappointments I had there, whatever great times I had there, there'll always be a special place in old Dave's ticker, not just because they accepted me, but they accepted me early. Here are 2 Ivy League schools I didn't get into, and I spent weeks waiting for the crushing blow of those thin little envelopes. Because if you get in, you get a whole orientation package, but if you don't, you get that form letter. We had so many good candidates this year, it's so hard to choose, blah, blah, blah. Which was their way of saying, sorry, your SAT scores were high, but not as high as the other white Jewish kids from your school. And we're glad you liked the chess club, but shame on you for not joining the debate team, the yearbook staff, community service organizations, and field trips. Have a great life. But NYU, and maybe their admissions have grown more exacting in recent years, but they sent me a thin envelope in the middle of January, and they're like, not only do we want you, but we're letting you know a few weeks before we even have to, just to show how much we want you. And it's nice to be wanted. And when the other 2 Hogwarts fell through, I sure wanted them. I just wanted to be loved. Is that so wrong? And speaking of love, I know this has been a self-indulgent episode of Dave's Gone By from start to finish, but now I'm really going to lay it on. This is courtesy of my wife, Joyce Weil. We'll be celebrating our 5th anniversary at the end of March, and she's got a special birthday present for me, which we will hear right after this. We're back with Dave's Gone By. The time is 8:54, time for me to shut up and listen to a special birthday surprise from my wife. Joyce has put together a special tape of some family, friends, people I know, wishing me a happy and spreading the love. So if you want to know where something like me comes from, give a listen to these folks. Thank you, hon. Let's hear it.
Happy birthday, David. I'm glad you're my son-in-law. I'm glad you're in the family. And happy birthday and many, many more. Love, your mother-in-law.
Happy birthday, David. You're a great lover. Don't let the wife know. Good frame.
Hello, David Lefkowitz. Happy birthday and a healthy birthday. Many, many, many more. You should live to be 116, and you look all shriveled, and you have to walk around, and people will be pointing at you and going, my God, look at that weird-looking old man. Jenna, you want to say, here's my daughter to wish you a happy birthday. She said that Puglish.
David, happy birthday, David. Hello?
And now my wife.
С днем рождения, Дэйв. Я желаю тебе есть побольше рыбы, и чтобы у тебя никогда не было поноса. Это самое главное пожелание. I wish you happy birthday in Russian, and I hope you'll never find the Russian translator to explain to you what I really said. And if you will find somebody, you can never sue me because I'm afraid of your wife. Happy birthday, Dave.
Hi, David. This is Aunt Bonnie to my favorite nephew. You've done us proud. We love your show. Keep on going. Love, Aunt Bonnie and Uncle Les, and Adam and Stephanie and Brett and Josh.
Hey David, it's Adam. I've heard that you recorded everybody when I was born, so the least I could do is wish you a happy birthday on your birthday. Have a very happy birthday.
Ring the doorbell.
Joyce, what happened to you?
Okay. Happy birthday, nephew David. May all your future birthdays be very, very happy and healthy ones. You're a great nephew, and we have two more dogs for you to adopt. And have a good one. Take care.
Hi, this is your mom, Dave.
This is your dad.
We want to wish you
a very happy birthday.
We love you and are very proud of you. Happy birthday to 120 days.
This has been a paid political announcement.
Bonjour, David. This is your French lover. Well, happy birthday. I guess 39 is pretty impressive. 6 years more than Jesus Christ. But, you know, you have only one chance, contrary to our Lord, so better enjoy your first life.
Hello, David. This is your Auntie Esther. What's new? Hope everything is okay. I just want to wish you a very happy birthday and hope that when you reach 40, you become a millionaire and all your heart's desires are granted.
Hi, David. It's your cousin, Deb.
And your new cousin, Bobby, the one you love so dearly and keep so close to your heart.
Happy birthday and many, many more.
Hello, David. This is your wife. I want to wish you a very happy birthday and tell you I love you very much. And I hope that you enjoy the tape because your family and friends have gone to great extents to tape themselves wishing you happy birthday messages. And by the way, honey, I hope you can afford the royalties because most of them are equity and they won't scale. I love you, honey. Have a happy birthday. Happy birthday, sweetie. Bye-bye.
My family and friends, gosh, whole bunch of people there, all of them nuts, but I want to thank all of them, and especially my beloved Mrs., a.k.a. Joyce Weil, for putting that together and giving me such a sweet birthday wish and such a sweet life. And let's face it, I deserve it. But I want to also thank my special guest, Scott Rodelitz, my great good friend. Thanks for his help on a couple of the musical numbers, too, and for a playlist of songs on this and previous episodes of Dave's Gone By, check our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. We keep adding great stuff to the site, photos, archival info, plus how to advertise, become a sponsor, or become a member of our growing Bystanders Club. We doubled our membership in the last couple of weeks, which is really neat. So if you want to join the club, it's still only $10, and you get all the cool club stuff, a bi-monthly newsletter, weekly email, the best of audio tape, and opportunities for other discounts and free items. Most of all, you're helping support the show, which you can also do just by telling folks about it, hounding them, physically abusing them until they say, okay, I'll listen, and point them to the website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. If you forget the URL, just Google search for Dave's Gone By, and we're right up top. More thank yous. Thank you, station manager Joey, engineer Paul, engineer Joe. Thanks for playing my father. I never realized Dad giggled so much, but Joe's a great sport. Listen to his show, Joe Salzone Live, Saturday nights at 7:30. Also Saturday nights, 5:30 to 6:30. Don't miss Don Lewis, hosting Entertainment Long Island about how to be a performer. Time to blow out the candles on this, the sweet 16th edition of Dave's Gone By, my self-indulgent birthday show. Please send your comments and suggestions that I look like a monkey and smell like one too to davesgoneby@aol.com or snail mail, Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557. See you next week, 7:30 Sunday night. Don't miss your Dave's Gone By. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday, dear me. Happy birthday. Gone by. And I will walk and talk in God and soul.